This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Sarah Susskind. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Milford Daily News covering the week of July 29th through August 4th, 2026. If you are listening on August 5th at 8 a.m., Poets' Corner is coming up next at 9 o'clock. Our first article, MBTA is lowering fares this fall. Massachusetts MBTA riders could save money this fall with three new discounts on public transportation. Governor Maura Healey, joined by MBTA General Manager Philip Eng and several others at the Belmont Commuter Rail Station, announced the new affordability initiatives on July 28th. They include an unlimited transfer window, the elimination of higher express bus fares, and free fares for some seniors. Plus, commuter rail discounts from the summer will continue into the fall, she said. Every year, we're looking for new ways to lower costs and make it easier for people to choose public transportation, Healey said in a press release. These new fare pilots and the extension of our commuter rail savings will put money back in people's pockets while giving more riders the flexibility they need to get to work, school, and everywhere in between. How can I save money on the T this fall? The MBTA is launching three new fare pilot programs in fall 2026. 1. Expanded two-hour transfer window. Beginning September 1st, riders can make a practically unlimited number of transfers between subways, buses, or ferries during a two-hour period rather than just the two times currently allowed, and only pay the highest fare incurred during that window. Riders must use the same form of payment for the transfers to apply. 2. Elimination of higher express bus fares. Beginning September 1st, most MBTA buses, even express bus routes that currently charge up to $4.25, will only cost the local bus fare, $1.70 for a full fare and 85 cents reduced. However, the program does not apply to the SL, 123, and W routes. 3. Discounts for car-free seniors. Massachusetts residents 75 and older who no longer drive will be eligible for free bus, subway, ferry, and commuter rail services, beginning at a date to be announced this fall. To qualify, residents must be age 75 or above and hold a Massachusetts ID card, but no driver's license. Summer discounts continue. The full savings come after Healey announced four commuter rail promotions earlier this summer, including free Fridays and discounts on monthly and weekend fares. In a press release, Healey said that those promotions led to a 50% increase in commuter rail ridership on Fridays and over 6,200 people taking advantage of the weekend discount. Free commuter rail services on Friday will come to an end at the end of August, but some of the other promotions have been extended through November. They are 50% off discount, calendar month commuter rail passes for September, October, and November will be discounted by 50%. $1 weekend companion fare. On any weekend commuter rail trip covered by their pass, Monthly pass holders may bring one companion for $1 each way. Our next article. Franklin Museum will explore local link to World War II Nagasaki bombing. An upcoming Franklin Historical Museum presentation will explore the town's connection to one of World War II's most consequential events through the life of Major General Charles W. Sweeney, pilot of the B-29 boxcar during the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, Japan. The program, Franklin's Connection to the Atomic Bombing of Nagasaki, will be presented by Franklin Historical Commission member Scott Mason on Sunday, August 9th, according to a community announcement. The illustrated presentation will examine Sweeney's role in the August 9, 1945 mission over Nagasaki and place the event within the broader context of World War II and the dawn of the nuclear age. More than 80 years later, historians continue to debate the military, political, and moral questions surrounding the use of atomic weapons. Sweeney was born in Lowell, grew up in Quincy, and served in the Army Air Forces before continuing his military career with the Massachusetts Air National Guard, according to the announcement. Less well known is that Sweeney later lived in Franklin. Drawing on historical photographs, military records, and personal accounts, Mason will trace Sweeney's journey from Massachusetts to the Pacific Theater, recount the Nagasaki mission, and discuss how the decorated veteran eventually became a Franklin resident. The program is geared towards history enthusiasts, veterans, students, educators, aviation buffs, and anyone interested in World War II, military aviation, and the decisions that shape the modern world, according to the announcement. A question and answer session will follow the presentation. The program begins at 1:15 p.m. at the Franklin Historical Museum, 80 West Central Street. Admission is free, although donations are welcome. Questions may be directed to Historical Commission Chair Alan Earls at alan.r.earls@gmail.com or 508-560-3786. Our next article. French-themed bakery rises to meet demand. Just a year and a half after opening its bakery in Wellesley, Le Petit Four has taken another major step. Le Petit has opened a 7,500-square-foot production facility at 110 Gould Street in Needham. The factory handles all preparation for the bakery's pastries, breads, and other menu items, freeing up space in Wellesley while also creating capacity for wholesale business, catering orders, and future expansion. "We outgrew the kitchen quite quickly," said Romain Bernas, who runs the business alongside his mother and founder Valerie Coulette. "Within 4 or 5 months, we realized, okay, I think this is going to be a problem. Rather than duplicating kitchens and staff at every future location, Bernas and Coulette chose to centralize production in Needham." "Both my mom and I were on the same page," Bernas said. "Recreating an entire team, given how hard it is to find good people, we can't do that. We can put all of our efforts into one main place with good people, where my mom can be, where I can go, where our head chef, Michel, can go and really make sure quality is always top-notch." Needham production facility nearly a year in the making. Needham was a natural fit. The bakery's Wellesley property manager owns the Needham building, and Bernas and Coulette each live there as well. Bernas oversaw the expansion project once the lease was signed in September 2025. For me to be the project manager and be on site every day really helped us think of the future, he said. It ended up being exactly what we wanted. The production facility includes larger freezers, specialized production areas, and a walk-in oven. Bernas said the expanded space has improved efficiency and consistency. At the end of the day, why do we go through all this? He asked. It's just to have consistency and consistent good quality. Today, all doughs, fillings, and other preparations are made in Needham before being delivered to Wellesley for baking. Separating production from baking has improved quality, Bernas said, particularly for delicate viennoiserie items such as croissants that require temperature-controlled conditions. Being able to separate the baking versus the prepping is actually huge in terms of keeping the quality or even making it better, he said. The expansion was expensive, but largely self-funded. We're just happy we don't have any big corporation or anyone else that owns it, Bernas said. The Needham factory allows Le Petit Four to welcome wholesale customers. The company has signed its first wholesale account and is pursuing partnerships with independent coffee shops. Bernas said large chains are not part of the plan. We owe it to everyone and to ourselves to do quality baked goods, he said. When you start producing on that level, especially for companies that want products to last days or a week, it's not really our brand. Our stuff is something you come and eat the same day. Bruno said the factory is critical to the business's long-term goal of opening two additional Massachusetts bakeries. The team is actively working on a second bakery that could open next spring. I think this gets us from being a one-location bakery to three, Bernas said. Three is kind of a golden number for us. Maintaining Le Petit Four's authentic French identity remains the priority. Coulette has shifted from day-to-day production to focus on training staff, maintaining standards, and developing new products after trips to France to learn from top pastry chefs. Future hopes for Le Petit Four. In 5 years, Bernas hopes the company will have three thriving bakeries while preserving the quality that built its reputation. And while the business has grown rapidly from its origins as a home kitchen, he said the team still takes pride in hearing customers compare their pastries to those found in France. One customer review, he said, perfectly captures what Le Petit Four strives to be. A trip to Paris in a bakery box. A lot of our customers come back and say, we went to Paris and honestly, we couldn't wait to have your croissant again. Bernas said, people think quality. They think, wow, I don't even have to travel to Paris to have the exact same quality. Our next article. Milford woman describes how she and a friend helped toddler at beach. For Vanessa Gomez and Beatriz Souza, a relaxing Sunday at Stoddard Park in Holliston was interrupted by a scream. A father screaming for help for his unconscious daughter. We were at the lake enjoying the day when I walked to the parking lot to answer a phone call, Gomez, who lives in Milford, told the Daily News in a phone interview on Monday night. As I was walking back, I heard people screaming. At first, I thought it might be a fight. But when I got closer, I realized a child had drowned and people were yelling for someone to call 911. Gomez said she immediately called 911. Then she and Souza, who recently became certified in CPR, jumped into action to help the little girl, whom she called a baby. She said the child's lips, face, arms, and hands had all turned blue from an apparent lack of oxygen. I knelt down beside her, supported the baby's head, and helped keep everyone calm so she, Souza, could focus on the resuscitation, Gomez said. I also asked the crowd to stop screaming and give us enough space to help the baby. My friend performed CPR correctly, and I stayed by her side the entire time, assisting her. While she was doing chest compressions, I cleared water from the baby's nose and mouth. We continued working together, and after about 3 minutes of CPR, the baby finally cried. Once the baby began crying, they laid her on her side to help her breathe, and her cries became stronger. Souza picked the baby up and ran to the ambulance when it arrived and handed the baby to paramedics, Gomez said. The Holliston Fire Department, in a press release, said the child was flown to UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester after the 6:55 p.m. incident to be treated. The father was also taken to the hospital because he fractured his knee rushing into the lake to save his daughter, Gomez said. Gomez said the end result was worth it because the child appears to be doing well. Today, I spoke with the family, and they told me the baby is doing well, she said. She's eating normally, there's no water in her lungs, and the doctors say she is doing great with no lasting damage. They expect she will be able to go home either Monday or Tuesday. The father is still in the hospital, receiving treatment for his fractured knee. Our next article. Bill would make two-family zoning the norm. The Massachusetts Senate, July 23rd, passed a measure it hopes will create unprecedented levels of new housing in Massachusetts. The legislation, included in the Senate's sweeping economic development bill, would apply automatic two-family zoning across Massachusetts, allowing duplexes to be built on most residential properties. Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland, said in a statement that the measure will provide opportunities for new families to find a home they can afford. Senator Michael Rodriguez, Democrat Westport, said it will spur housing development. Housing advocates say this measure could help tackle the state's housing crisis. Under current zoning laws, only one-third of the state's land allows duplexes by right, Abundant Housing Massachusetts said in a press release. This simple solution could unlock thousands of new homes to address our housing affordability crisis. As the Senate's economic development bill is different from the House's, the two chambers must come to an agreement in conference committees before it goes to Governor Maura T. Healey's desk. How does the bill make two-family zoning automatic? The bill would effectively end single-family zoning by allowing duplexes to be built in most residential zones. No zoning ordinance or bylaw shall prohibit, unreasonably restrict, or require a special permit or other discretionary zoning approval for the use of land or structures for a single duplex on lots zoned for residential use, the bill reads. There are some restrictions. Municipalities can set standards for height and design, and properties that need septic systems can be exempt. But standards cannot be unreasonably restrictive. A local regulation, ordinance, or bylaw shall not be more restrictive of duplexes than of single-family dwellings, and shall not, individually or cumulatively, render the development of a duplex physically or financially infeasible, the bill says. Regulations are only allowed if they address a specific, articulable concern that cannot be addressed by less restrictive means. Massachusetts housing crisis. Massachusetts is in a housing crisis, according to the state government's website, with some of the highest home prices in the country. A June poll from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center found a majority of Massachusetts residents believe housing, or the cost of living, is the most important problem facing the state. A July poll from the same center found that 1/3 of residents said they are likely to leave the state within the next 5 years, largely because of the cost of housing and living. On top of other statewide efforts, including a ballot question that aims to make more affordable starter homes, the bill takes other steps to combat the problem. It also authorizes $2.5 million for a pilot program that helps construct permanently affordable homeownership units or units for low and moderate income households. Our next article, Smashing Success, Logan Remote Terminal Pilot Extended Through March. Framingham. Less than 2 months after launching a first-in-the-nation pilot program that allows travelers to clear airport security before arriving at Boston Logan International Airport, Massachusetts Port Authority officials announced the Framingham initiative will continue through spring 2027. The remote terminal at 19 Flutie Pass in Framingham officially opened on June 1st for JetBlue and Delta passengers using the Logan Express service. During an event on July 28th, Massport CEO Rich Davey announced the pilot will now be extended through March 2027. Davey said the pilot program has been well received by travelers over the past 8 weeks, describing it as a smashing success. The program recently served its 10,000th passenger. We've heard great feedback from our customers, great feedback from our team, who have been out there early in the morning, making sure that our customers are taken care of, Davey said during the event. How the remote terminal works. The Framingham facility replicates the experience of checking in at Logan Airport with a traditional baggage check setup where gate agents process luggage and send it through the standard screening system. From there, passengers proceed through full TSA screening, staffed by TSA agents and equipped with the same technology used at Logan's terminals. After clearing security, travelers wait in a secured seating area before boarding a Logan Express bus. Once the bus arrives at the airport, passengers are dropped off directly on the air side of terminals, bypassing security lines at the airport. Massport partnered with TSA and Landline, a third-party contractor that operates similar secure land-to-air transfer programs in Pennsylvania and Illinois. I really believe that in the last 60 days, I've seen that this is the future of travel, Davey said. More airlines, locations under consideration. Davey said demand has grown steadily during the pilot's first 8 weeks, with some days filling the facility's parking lot to capacity. He said Massport plans to address parking limitations as the program expands. Other airlines have also expressed interest in participating. What we need to do at Logan is create the space in Terminal B where they can be dropped off, Davey said. We're anxious to get United, American, Southwest, and some of those other airlines involved as well. Massport is working on adding a remote terminal location at the Braintree Logan Express Station, which could be operational in a few years. Officials are also looking at adding a terminal at either the Woburn or Danvers Logan Express stations, as well as one in Boston at either the Menino Convention Center or Heinz Convention Center. Westboro Traveler becomes 10,000th passenger. Massport marked a milestone during Tuesday's event by recognizing Westboro resident Deepak Khandelwal as the program's 10,000th customer. Khandelwal, who was traveling to Cincinnati, said the service offers a less stressful and more affordable alternative to driving directly to Logan. "It's very easy, easy to navigate, very easy to buy tickets," he said. "It offered me a better option than a very long, expensive Uber ride into the airport today. I live here in Metro West, so I would definitely use the service again." The Framingham facility is open at 3 a.m. daily and serves flights departing from 5:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. The cost of the service matches the existing Logan Express fare at $9. Parking at the Framingham Remote Terminal is $7 per day, a significant savings compared to Logan Airport's $46 daily rate. Tickets remain free for passengers 17 and under. Each bus holds up to 55 passengers. Our next article: firefighters criticize handling of on-duty injuries. The state labor organization representing union firefighters is publicly criticizing Wayland's handling of on-duty firefighter injuries, alleging town officials delayed or denied work-related injury claims and leaving some firefighters at risk of losing income and health insurance. In an open letter dated June 30th and addressed to Wayland residents, Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts President Rich McKinnon Jr. alleged that several local firefighters have had injury claims denied or delayed under town manager Michael McCall. McKinnon told the Daily News that his organization became involved after hearing concerns from the Wayland Firefighters Union, IAFF Local 1978. The Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts represents local unions throughout the state and often assists with larger concerns. "We want our firefighters taken care of," McKinnon said. "They give a lot to the communities they serve. Injuries do occur commonly doing this job, and when they do, we want them taken care of. Not only for the firefighters, but their families." Dispute over injury benefits. McKinnon alleges that three Wayland firefighters were injured on duty and that McCall delayed placing them on benefits under Massachusetts General Laws Chapter 41, Section 111F, which provides paid leave for police officers and firefighters injured on duty. Under 111F, injured police officers and firefighters receive full pay while municipalities cover medical expenses related to the injury. McKinnon alleges that firefighters were forced to rely on their personal health insurance while waiting for claims to be approved. McCall, who in 2023 became Wayland's first town manager, did not respond directly to the allegations outlined by McKinnon. But in a written statement shared with the Daily News, he said Wayland is committed to supporting its firefighters. "The town of Wayland supports and appreciates the noble work and sacrifices of our professional firefighters," McCall wrote. "We offer some of the most competitive starting salaries in the region for firefighters, and we work to ensure that the men and women of the department have modern and efficient equipment and apparatus and advanced training." The town of Wayland has a long history of cordial and professional negotiations with all of our employee unions, and we actively negotiate in good faith at all times. The town will continue to negotiate in the best interests of both our residents, taxpayers, and our employees. While we are actively engaged in this process, the town will not negotiate in the media nor comment on personnel, contract negotiations, or pending legal matters. Arbitration pending in firefighter's case. McKinnon's letter specifically references the case of a female firefighter who was injured on duty and later had her 111F benefits terminated. McKinnon said the firefighter was removed from 111F status in June 2025, despite medical documentation indicating she continued to suffer from job-related injuries. An arbitration hearing on the matter is scheduled for August 18th, he said. She had all the documentation to state that she still needed to be on 111F after she was still dealing with injuries created by the job, McKinnon said. She also recently had a baby that had health care needs, too. When you come off of 111F and get put on unpaid leave, which I believe she is on now, she doesn't have the ability to have health insurance. McKinnon added that the case was highlighted in the letter because it has remained unsolved for months, which he said is unusual for 111 disputes. Staffing concerns. Another concern voiced in the letter was about staffing levels at the Wayland Fire Department. According to the letter, the department operates below recommended staffing levels 76% of the time. McKinnon argued that understaffing increases risks for firefighters and may contribute to workplace injuries. McKinnon also said that according to the National Fire Protection Association's recommendation, there should be 4 firefighters per piece of apparatus, which many municipalities, including Wayland, typically do not meet. It puts the burden on the firefighters that are there working. It exposes them to more hazards and dangerous situations, McKinnon said. They're working on top of their assigned shifts, so it does have the potential to increase injuries because obviously you're exposed to it. Our next article. Retired area teacher pens third novel. A retired Natick teacher recently published his third novel, Slider, which draws inspiration from decades of Massachusetts baseball memories and a lifelong connection to the state. Peter Alderman taught for 37 years at the Bennett Hemingway Elementary School and Wilson Middle School before becoming a writer, according to a community announcement. He and his wife, Pam, raised their 3 sons in Holliston. Now living in Franklin, Tennessee, Alderman is near his sons, Chris, Sean, and Jason, their families, and 7 grandsons. But his ties to Massachusetts continue to influence his work, according to the announcement. Slider, which was released last fall, combines baseball and suspense, tracing a path familiar to New England fans, according to the announcement. Summers spent on Cape Cod, league games, and following the Boston Red Sox helped inspire the story. Alderman also drew inspiration from Holliston native Mark Sweeney's baseball journey from high school to the University of Maine, the Cape League, and Major League Baseball. The novel's title came from a conversation with a coach at one of his grandson's baseball games, according to the announcement. A slider, a breaking pitch known for its late movement, caught Alderman's attention and ultimately became the name of the book. Slider opens at Yankee Stadium before taking readers through several Massachusetts locations. The story weaves together suspense, history, and local settings including North Adams, Cape Cod, Fenway Park, and Boston. According to the announcement, the novel features colorful characters, unexpected twists, and a tale of retribution that builds toward a surprising ending. Our next article. Legislation intends to ban crypto ATM kiosks. Amendment seeks to crack down on scams using the machines. In 2022, a Maynard woman almost lost $10,000 to Bitcoin scammers through a crypto ATM. In 2025, police saved a woman from losing $20,000 in another Bitcoin ATM scam in Lakeville. In these cases, the victims had been contacted by scammers posing as authority figures who invented emergencies and told them to immediately send money through a crypto ATM. But once the money is transferred in one of these machines, the chances of getting it back are near zero. In the past 5 years, these scams have skyrocketed, according to a press release from the office of Senator John Cronin, Democrat, Fitchburg. In the last year alone, Massachusetts residents have lost nearly $7 million to crypto ATM scams, according to AARP. Some seniors have lost their entire life savings. Now, lawmakers are trying to prevent future victims by cracking down on the machines themselves. Early on July 24th, the Massachusetts Senate passed legislation to ban crypto ATM kiosks in Massachusetts as part of its economic development bill. I was proud to pass the amendment that bans crypto ATM kiosks, but more importantly, that saves people in the Commonwealth from future predatory scams. Cronin, who filed the amendment, said in a statement, "This amendment is a strong consumer protection measure that recognizes the unique dangers posed by these machines. It recognizes that regulation is not enough when the risk is the machine itself. And it recognizes that the Commonwealth has a responsibility to act before more residents lose their savings, their homes, and their financial security." Bill seeks to ban crypto ATMs. The amendment bans virtual currency kiosks from operating in Massachusetts. Virtual currency kiosks, or crypto ATMs, are physical kiosks that convert cash into cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. While they look like traditional ATMs and are similarly often located in convenience stores, they do not connect to a bank account and instead link directly to a digital wallet to transfer digital assets, according to Cronin's office. The amendment gives the Attorney General the authority to bring a civil action against anyone who operates a crypto ATM in the state. What's next? The crypto ATM ban was not included in the House's version of the economic development bill, so the two chambers will have to come to an agreement in conference committees before it can go to Governor Maura Healey's desk. Four states, including Vermont, have already passed bans on crypto ATMs, as have a few towns in Massachusetts. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell issued a statement supporting the legislation, saying it will strengthen consumer safeguards and protect residents from harm. Campbell has already worked to crack down on crypto ATMs in the state. In February, her office sued cryptocurrency kiosk operator Bitcoin Depot for facilitating scams, causing them to close all their locations in Massachusetts. Our next article. Newly found letter shows defiant Susan B. Anthony. A newly discovered handwritten letter reveals Susan B. Anthony's response days after her 1872 arrest for illegally voting. The Rabb Collection announced July 23rd that it had acquired the previously unknown letter, which Anthony addressed to President Ulysses S. Grant 1 week after her arrest in Rochester, New York. Anthony was arrested after voting in the presidential election, saying the 14th and 15th Amendments guaranteed her right to vote. In the letter, she urged Grant to support legislation defining Americans' rights, argued all citizens should be allowed to vote, and compared his leadership to a monarchy. Although historians believe Anthony intended to send the letter, there is no evidence it ever reached the president. The document remained in a private collection for more than 50 years before it was offered to the collection. The Rabb Collection has listed it for sale at $45,000. Nathan Rabb, president of the Rabb Collection, said the letter captures Anthony's frustration following her arrest and reveals the emotion behind her constitutional argument for women's voting rights. What you're getting in this letter is Anthony's unfiltered thoughts, feelings, and wishes in the face of one of the more challenging moments in her life, and certainly a setback in the fight for women to vote legally, Rabb said. I should say legally, because they did vote. It's just their votes didn't count, and they were arrested for it. Rabb said Anthony's message extended beyond her own case. She was frustrated on her own behalf, but also that there were other women who had been arrested with her and were still in prison. He said, I can only imagine her intense emotion knowing that there were other women in prison for voting. One detail Rabb believes readers might overlook comes in Anthony's closing words, where she speaks out on behalf of not only herself, but every woman in a similar position. She signs the letter on behalf of all women, he said, writing for the more than half of the population of the country who couldn't vote and had fewer rights. As many U.S. residents celebrated the nation's 250th anniversary this year, Rabb said the letter serves as a reminder that fulfilling the nation's founding ideals required generations of continued struggle. The idea that we can all vote, we can go in there and vote as equals, is something that people fought for. It wasn't just given to them, he said. Read the full letter at rabcollection.com. RABCOLLECTION.com. Our next article, Geothermal Project. Can energy program work in Marlboro? The success achieved by Framingham's geothermal pilot project has caught the eye of a city councilor in neighboring Marlboro. Ward 2 City Councilor David Doucette wants to evaluate the potential benefits, costs, and feasibility of Marlboro having its own geothermal energy program, saying it could help the city reduce dependence on fossil fuels and provide a more stable and cost-effective source of energy for residents and businesses. The world market and stuff that happens on the other side of the world definitely impacts the cost of fossil fuels for us, said Doucette, who is serving his 6th 2-year term as city councilor. The less dependent we are on imported energy, and the more dependent we become on our own energy, we create huge advantages for ourselves as a municipality. Geothermal networks use underground pipes to transfer heat between buildings and the earth, providing heating and cooling without relying on fossil fuels. Inspired by Framingham's pilot, Doucette said he has followed geothermal energy for several years, but it was Framingham's geothermal network pilot that sparked his interest in potentially bringing the technology to Marlboro. Framingham is participating in a first-in-the-nation pilot program with Eversource that uses underground wells and a shared loop system to provide heating and cooling to homes and businesses. There are currently 16 homes, 2 commercial buildings, and 108 Framingham Housing Authority customers involved, with more planned. That definitely really had me thinking about how it could be done in Marlborough, Doucette said. The question is, really, is it going to be a municipal utility or a public utility? A municipal utility would be owned and operated by the city rather than a private utility provider. The idea has been presented to the planning board and, on July 21st, to the City Council's Climate Resiliency Committee after the full council referred the proposal to the subcommittee for further discussion. Countryside Village site discussed as possible pilot. One proposal discussed by Doucette involves a wastewater thermal exchange network serving the Countryside Village area on Boston Post Road, Route 20. This involves using heat captured from municipal or building sewage systems to heat and cool nearby buildings. During the July 21st Climate Resiliency Committee meeting, Doucette said a 30-inch sewer line running in front of the development could make the location viable for such a project. He added that some Marlborough businesses are already exploring alternative energy sources. Audrey Shulman, founder and executive director of Black Swan Lab, a Cambridge organization that works on climate solutions, said during the meeting that wastewater-based geothermal systems could provide heating and cooling for hundreds of homes, depending on the amount of wastewater available. Every 1 million gallons per day of wastewater, you can get basically enough heating and cooling for 100 homes, she said. Funding and feasibility remain key questions. Doucette said the next step would be determining the financial implications of any geothermal project. He said there are state incentives and grants available to support geothermal development. Federal incentives are also available for projects implemented before 2033, which he said is one reason he wanted to begin exploring the idea now. The city could also consider tax increment finance agreements, or TIFs, as part of a funding strategy. Official project costs would not be known until a feasibility study is completed. The study would evaluate installation expenses, engineering and design requirements, and overall project viability. Ward 1 Councillor Mark Vital said during the July 21st meeting that it's important to determine Marlborough's vision for geothermal energy as a whole, not just look at individual projects. Doucette responded by saying the city could test the energy model with the Countryside site and, if successful, explore other options. He said city officials must consider not only how to fund an initial project, but also examine how future expansion can be financed. Doucette emphasized that the initiative is in its early stages and said a non-binding referendum could potentially be considered in 2027. In the meantime, city officials will continue exploring the feasibility of a geothermal network. Our next article, CVS begins filling pet prescriptions. Your next CVS run could involve picking up medications for your puppy alongside your own prescriptions. In a July 21st announcement, CVS said its pharmacies would begin filling prescriptions for select pet medications, including antibiotics, allergy medications, flea and tick control, insulin, and pain relievers. The Woonsocket Base Company said the service is now available for dogs and cats at all 9,000 stores nationwide. With the addition of pet medication dispensing, CVS Pharmacy can now serve every member of the family, said Sid Tennedy, Senior Vice President and Interim President of Pharmacy and Consumer Wellness at CVS Health. The pharmacy giant joins other major chains, including Walmart and Walgreens, in the pet prescription medication department. CVS also said it recently added pet essentials from several brands, including Milk-Bone, Greenies, Churu, Savory Prime, and Temptations, to its store shelves. Here's what to know about filling pet prescriptions at your local CVS. How to have your pet's prescriptions filled at CVS. Pet owners who want to have their pet's prescriptions filled at CVS can either bring a written prescription to the pharmacy or ask their veterinarian to contact CVS directly, the company said. Once CVS receives the prescription, the owner can then choose to pick up the medication in store or have it delivered if eligible. Customers can also add their pets to their CVS.com profile and manage eligible pet prescriptions through the CVS Health app, the company said. The pharmacy said it expects to be able to accept electronic prescriptions for pet medications starting later this year. Our next article, Massachusetts candidates have raised $26.3 million in 2026. Massachusetts candidates running for office this fall have raised over $26.3 million in the first half of 2026, according to data from the Office of Campaign and Political Finance. That number includes money raised by most candidates running for state and county positions in Massachusetts, but not for federal offices like U.S. Senate or House. It also doesn't include county races such as commissioner or a special election for sheriff. Candidates reported spending $15 million, a press release said. Over half of that money comes from the governor's race, and over $10 million comes from a single candidate. Here's a breakdown of how much Massachusetts candidates have spent and raised this year. Statewide races. More than half of the total fundraising and spending by Massachusetts candidates was done by the 11 candidates running for statewide offices, including for governor, attorney general, and state treasurer. They have raised over $16.6 million and spent over $8.3 million combined. The governor's race, in which two Republicans are challenging Governor Maura Healey, accounts for the vast majority of that, with candidates having raised $14.4 million and spent $8.3 million total. Here's about how much all the statewide candidates have raised this year to date, according to OCPF data. Governor. Governor Maura Healey, Democrat, $2.6 million. Michael Minogue, Republican, $10.4 million. Brian Shortsleeve, Republican, $1.4 million. Lieutenant Governor. Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, Democrat, $1 million. Sean Oliver, Republican, $106,143. Attorney General. Attorney General Andrea Campbell, Democrat, $534,134. And Michael Walsh, Republican, $51,515. Secretary of State, William Galvin, Democrat, $121,062. Treasurer. Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Democrat, 144,708. Elizabeth Dion, Republican, $202,658. And Auditor. Auditor Diana DiZoglio, Democrat, $92,454. House and Senate. There are 308 candidates for State House and Senate this year who have in total raised about $7.7 million and spent $5.8 million. Senate candidates account for most of the money. On average, Senate candidates have raised $45,945 and spent $36,452. House candidates, on average, raised $19,446 and spent $14,061. District Attorney. There are 23 candidates running for 11 district attorney seats, including 8 candidates running for Norfolk County District Attorney. In total, they have raised about $1.45 million and spent $666,196. Register of Probate. The 16 candidates running for 14 Register of Probate seats have raised $222,167 and spent $107,397 in total. Governor's Council. Governor's Council candidates have raised $223,928 and spent $79,563. 6 of 8 seats are contested, with 14 candidates total. You have been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Sarah Susskind. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Noir. I'm Private Eye Michael Stein. Every good investigator knows to stay vigilant for suspicious behavior. But a call from my old friend Cora reminded me that there's often more to a bird than meets the eye.
Michael, I just found the strangest bird. He looked like a crow, but sounded all wrong.
That does seem odd, Cora. Could he be a common raven? They look like giant crows that sound deep and croaky.
No, his calls were more short and nasal. I even said to him, "What, you got a cold or something?" And that bird called back to me saying, "Uh-uh." I mean, the whole thing seems fishy to me.
Fishy is right, but not for the reason you think. In most of the U.S., the American crow is the only crow in town. That's the caw you're probably used to. But on the Atlantic coast, and parts of the Midwest too, the fish crow is a common city bird. The two species look the same, but the fish crow's nasal caw is unmistakable.
Huh? I had no idea there were two kinds of crows.
Actually, there are more than 30 species worldwide.
Okay, wise guy. I'll drop you a line if any of them come cawing.
Yep, another case closed. For Bird Noir, I'm Private Eye Michael Stein.
Would you like to hear news from Barry and Spencer that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 6 p.m.